Organize with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, and welcome to the 98th episode of Robots. I am Jana, and in today's episode, we will be looking at self-organization in modular and swarm robotics with Radhika Najpal from Harvard. But first, as always, here are the news with Christine.
Thank you. Researchers at Harvard's Microrobotics Lab have demonstrated a new construction method for microrobots. The method works by first creating a flat, two-dimensional model out of several layers of carbon fiber, brass, and thin flexible plastic. Then, using a combination of smart scaffolding and alternating soft and hard layers to form joints, the 2D model is popped into place in sort of a pop-up book and origami fashion. The resulting three-dimensional robot is then dip-soldered to lock the design into place, before laser cutting the final robot from the carrier material. In a video, the researchers show how their process can create a tiny bee robot about the size of a quarter that can beat its wings at 30 Hz. If you're interested in mechanical design and like Legos, you will be deeply impressed by an anthropomorphic Lego arm and hand created by artist-engineer Max Shepard. The hand is built entirely out of Lego, has 12 degrees of freedom, and can pick up a bottle and pour water into a glass. To have a look at a video of the Lego robot hand, Harvard's microrobot origami manufacturing, as well as other recent news, have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Radhika Najpal is the director of the Self-Organized Systems Research Group at the Wyss Institute of Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard. Her work takes inspiration from biological systems, such as multicellular organisms and social insects, including ants and termites. She spoke to our reporter Per about a number of her projects, including self-balancing modular tables and the Kilobot, which we already touched on in a previous episode. She also talks about collective construction, or the idea that robots can actually build the environment in which they evolve.
Welcome, Radhika.
Thank you. I'm glad to be podcasted.
Yeah. So what inspired you to work with modular robotics? How did you discover the area?
When I was a graduate student, I worked on a project called Amorphous Computing. And the idea behind that project was conceived by actually a number of different people, but they were interested in what happens when computing is like physics. You could have all these particles, each particle has some computation power, and if you want more, you just add more particles. And so you bought the particles like you bought rice, and you poured more rice when you wanted more power. And the idea was that, you know, if you have that many particles that compute, you have to start thinking in a completely different way than we think about computers today, where we worry about every computer on the internet, or we worry about every iPod, or nothing is disposable, everything is remembered, everything has a name and an ID. So now you just have to think about things in bulk. And that really appealed to me. So I started to look at biology and how cells interact, how cells self-assemble into complex organisms. And in the process, I discovered that I wasn't the only one, that there was this whole area of modular robotics, projects like the CBOT, which was very early on, which was really cellular robotics. Mm-hmm. And that was very exciting to me. So I started thinking about pattern formation and self-assembly and programming, and got to know all these people who were thinking about how you would actually build the cell or build these many particles that would then come together and do interesting things in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did the same thing. I started out just knowing nothing, and then you discover something, and maybe you go to a conference,
yeah,
and then you meet a lot of people.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
So you're at Harvard now, and you have a lab. You're running a number of projects. Is there any of the old ones that are history now that you'd care to mention before we go into the ones that 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 you're doing working on right now?
Well, I think, you know, every year things change in the group. You know, the you swing from thinking about theory and computation to thinking about how you build the particles and the hardware, and then back to the theory and the computation. And so people often ask me, you know, what do you like more? Or is it more important to do theory and mathematics, or is it more important to do hardware? And I thought, you know, the reality is it's wonderful when you can do both. So for example, one of my students, Chihan, worked on modular robotics, and he was interested in how things adapt to the environment. And in his research, what he found is that when we thought of things like a modular robotics table, mm-hmm. a table that could adapt and sort of keep things level, or a whole walkway with many, many legs, so it's like a very, very long table mm-hmm. that now has to keep track of its of surface and stay straight, that in fact that had a lot to do with how a bunch of birds, a big flock of birds, could find the same direction and flow together.
The
how
self-organizing
concept. Exactly. So there are common ideas in self-organization that are just very powerful, and you keep finding them in different ways. You know, you find out that fireflies use this, and birds use this, and cells use this.
And even flowers. I know the sunflower organize. The way a plant grows is based on self-organization.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, if you think of plants, they're constantly adapting to the environment. They don't fall over out of the pot, right? They actually balance all of their internal roots and branches yeah. just the way we were trying to make this walkway that balances no matter how the environment changes. So that to me was really exciting, because I think when we think of humans, we always think that the brain is involved. Mm-hmm. But if you think of a plant, nobody's confused. Nobody thinks that at the base of the plant is this perfect brain that collects the information from all of the leaves mm-hmm. computes the perfect optimal solution and tells everybody what to do.
No, and even though, as you said, it doesn't fall over, and if you tip it over, it's going to self-correct.
That's right. That's right. And so all of these properties must be coming from this distributed system of cells somehow, you know, between the growth hormones that they exchange, mm-hmm. between the interactions of each cell with gravity, each cell with tension, each cell with sunlight.
Yeah. yeah.
These are all integrated in some way. And I feel that we could just learn so much from that. And Chihan took a lot of ideas from that, and he showed that you could transform those ideas to self-balancing tables or pressure adaptive grippers mm-hmm. or
yeah, we've all seen
locomotion.
The balloon gripper, huh?
Yeah, and we even did things with locomotion where, you know, we tried to create a blob-like cell mm-hmm. that basically could, you know, slither across a surface or tumble or even climb up little areas, all by this sensing and actuation combination without really a brain mm-hmm. that is coordinating all of the aspects, really, with this distributed
part. The locomotion just emerges from a few set of basic rules.
That's right. And if each person or each element, each agent in this system does those local rules, then it's the combination that matters. And I think to understand that sometimes is really hard. So we try to use mathematical tools that help us understand why it works, mm-hmm. when it's not going to work. And that way, it actually makes it easier to build things, because then when it doesn't work, you know that the problem was with the hardware you built, not with the algorithm that you designed, or you know that where the mismatches might be. So mm-hmm. So that was an exciting project to me, and maybe one of the first projects in my lab where we really started building robots. And now, thanks to Chihan, like, my whole lab has really transformed. We now build a lot of different kinds of robots.
So you moved, that caused you to move from theoretical mathematics to hardware, including
that's right,
hardware.
That's right. Just the ability to do theory and hardware at the same time is really fun. I mean, I think it's also fun. You tangibly see mm-hmm. things move around. We had a lot of fun with the table. We would balance all kinds of things on it, show it to kids.
Yeah, also when he just pulled it towards himself, he climbed up into the sofa.
Yeah, and put a paper on it, you know, and we would use it to discuss, you know, to invent new ideas, because you show it to somebody, and then the somebody watching it will say, oh, that reminds me of, you know, something else, and you're like, wow, I never thought of that. Mm-hmm. So it's exciting to have physical objects as well.
Yeah, that's something I also discovered, that whenever I get my hands on these, and the only one I ever actually had my hands on are the cubelets from Modular Robotics, is that having them there and playing with them and trying to solve problems with them, it's not always obvious and easy, but you do workarounds, you do hacks. That workarounds or hacks are hard to think about before you're in the situation. So having them in front of you and working with them is really powerful, huh?
And it can also open your mind to different things. Like one of the things I really love about modular robots is that the end product doesn't have to look like a robot. It doesn't have to look like a snake robot or a spider. It could look like a table. It could look like a chair. It could look like a tripod that follows the sun or looks for objects and follows it all the time. Anything that you want to actuate that is multi-jointed, multi-flexible. Yeah, you can just imagine that you had these modules and you put them together and you get anything you need.
Yeah, yeah.
So we once discussed this project, which I'm going to say on this because we never did it, and I think it would be a really, really fun one to do.
Yeah, hopefully somebody takes you
up
on this.
Yeah, like, please take it up. You have a backpack full of modules, and you go on a camping trip. And the question is, can you make everything you need? You know, the chair sitting in front of the fire, the suspension that holds things above a fire, the tripod that's following the bird you care about, you know, the poles of your tent. I don't know, anything.
Yeah.
So this occurred to me because I had been reading about Jane Goodall and, you know, her following the animals and you know, trying to move through this environment.
Very hard.
You have to carry everything you need. If everything you carry is a different object, then
it's not going to work.
Yeah. It's not going to work, you know, so it's better maybe to carry wood and hammers and nails to build the thing and then unbuild it and build the new thing.
The problem there is, of course, that they're consumables. I mean, when you cut the board to a certain size,
that's right.
Suddenly you're gonna end up with a lot of very small boards.
That's right. And so those are consumables, and they're also not active. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you wanted a rig that did anything, you know, what would that be? So we thought, oh, you know, if you could make that would be a great modular robotics kit, the one that you would take with you camping, and it would, you know, how many of things that you set up and take could you just replace by this actuation?
And of course, the better the modules and the more generic the modules are, the more they can be reused.
Exactly. And,
so that was a very good analogy. I certainly hope that
I hope somebody tries it.
They can also make a wood version and an urban version.
Yeah, I was like telescoping rods. That would be one useful element maybe. And then sort of actuation that's hinge-like or actuation that's rotation-like.
Yep.
This is one of the things I think people in modular robotics have discovered, you know, what are the different useful actuations? What are the primitives exactly that are useful to have? And if you cover those primitives, what are the structural elements that are useful to have? And if you have a kit that is that combination, maybe you specialize it for camping. But I think it would be a really exciting kit. Like every kid who went on a camping trip would create the tent of their choice and the chair of their choice and the waving flag of their choice and, you know, the dog throwing ball of your choice. I mean, you could build anything you wanted.
And having this in front of you, especially if you have that all the way from you're a kid until you're an adult, you simply think differently. And this is how kids use computers today. They're so used to them that they just go do.
That's right.
And I think that even if we have a camping trip kit and we have an industrial kit and we have a kit for the urban environment, most of those things are going to be the same.
That's right. And I think many of the primitives are going to be the same.
Yeah. Building structures, it's everything about Newton, right? Hold things up.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think you could have kits that really specialized in, you know, snake robots, spider robots, climbing robots, arms, hands, manipulation. That's a very, you know, remote robots kind of feel. And then the camping one fundamentally might look very different, but I bet you the primitives would be very similar. You know, I could see that you might want things that pinch and hold, so a manipulator kind of thing. And you'd want hinges and you'd want rotations and you could have wheels on things.
Yeah, because they're so
they're fundamentally very, very related. And that's actually how I got into maybe the area that's more new in my lab is this idea that if you keep going down that path of saying, okay, modular robots, modular tables and chairs or whatever, you can go all the way to modular architecture. And that's actually not a new topic at all.
No.
Architects think about modularity because they want to build many different kinds of structures from the same kind of object. So, you know, the ultimate one is the brick, right? It's just one module.
Because it would be ridiculously expensive to do sheetrock factory for just one project.
Exactly.
It wouldn't be possible.
Exactly. You know, I think once you move to concrete, you actually have a different kind of feel. You can actually make molds and, you know, create structures. But
bricks, even though the molds are actually modular in
there
them.
There you go. Then you have to make the molds. So that's an area that now I've gotten really interested in, where it sort of melds modular robotics and swarm robotics, which is also kind of a modular robotics because you're saying you have a lot of robots of the same kind.
It's just that they're not connected. They're not. I mean, I see that it's a pretty natural transition between swarm and the modular and self-reconfiguring modular robotics.
Absolutely.
Because they can connect and disconnect.
Yeah, and it's true in nature too, because when I started, I was really excited about cellular biology. So how is it that cells in an organism can form specific patterns and structures and self-assemble? But over time, I've learned more and more about ants. And if you go to the other extreme and you think of army ants, they self-assemble bridges and, nests
The nest too.
From their own body. So they're forming this complicated structure that's really quite amazing from their bodies. And so now you have the cells that form the ants that then form things with their bodies like cells.
It's just the level of magnitude.
Exactly, exactly. And so it really is that self-assembly comes in so many forms. And I think in that case, it's architecture. So
what the ants are doing is self-reconfiguring modular architecture.
Exactly. So they're making their bivouac, which is their nest, or they're making bridges. I mean, to us, that's architecture, right? Making a bridge or making a shelter. So we started looking at, you know, what would it take for us to take these ideas of self-assembly and rather than shrinking the elements down to be smaller and smaller, basically push the elements to be larger and larger. Like, can you make robots that move around blocks of some sort and basically build structures from that, like build walls or build a castle or, you know, build an overhang or build bridges? And, you know, we're certainly not as far as building bridges or overhangs or anything like that yet.
But that's your goal.
But that's my goal. That's my goal, to be able to build things in the presence of gravity, have robots climb up the things, the very things that they build themselves.
And so they will, as the ants do, they use what they built as a scaffolding for the next step. Then.
That's right. That's right. Very much what we do, right? We build bridges so that it's easier to get across a river, right? And so, you know, we build things and then we walk over them and we may use that bridge to carry more wood over to build the next thing we want to build, you know? And so I think that one of the things I learned from talking to the biologists who study ant behavior and termite behavior is that they believe that controlling the environment is perhaps, you know, the most interesting thing an organism can evolve. Is it's part of evolutionary smarts, is to be able not to constantly have your fitness determined by the environment, but to change the environment to be more fit for you and control. So his argument was that engineers and architects are in fact the most evolved of the species. And I thought that was a wonderful thing. I was like, yes.
But this is fascinating. I think it's because it's also so that better housing, both for the professional thing, where if it's a factory, if it's an office, and also for the home,
right,
is very significant.
Right. So if you think about termites, for example, they create these huge mounds. They're millimeter sized themselves, and they create these mounds that are, you know, meters high.
Oh yeah,
tens of meters high.
Yeah, and they also go deep.
Right.
Down.
And so if you look inside those mounds, they're really interesting structures. So they have structures where the humidity and the heat is basically being controlled by its position in the mound. It's being placed very low in the mound, and that's where they grow, for example, the fungus that eats the cellulose, that basically produces something that they can consume. So that's their garden. And then they have
stomach.
You could stomach, or you could call it their agriculture. That's where they basically do their agriculture. And then they have, you know, the chambers where they keep all the larvae, and then that has certain requirements. And then throughout the mound, they create these ventilation systems that actually do a lot to regulate the different gases that are there. So you're doing all this metabolism, you're producing huge amounts of CO2. You've got to, you know, get that out and get all the oxygen in. And so you want to create these currents through it that are cleaning out your system.
And that's maybe why they have the high tower on top to create the chimney effect.
So different species create different architectures. And this is one of the things that Scott Turner, who's a termite biologist, studies. And he believes that the structure of the mound is really like a lung. So you have like the main sort of section, or the main tubes, and then it forks into the smaller tubes and the smaller tubes and the smaller tubes.
Yeah, exactly like lung does.
And so within the mound, you actually have that similar structure. And so it actually creates similar ways of shuttling air and filtering air as the lung does. So he thinks that essentially they've made an external lung to control, you know, basically get rid of CO2 and use the oxygen and keep
Which, of course, also made it possible for them to make themselves smaller, I guess, because
a lot
of their metabolism is external rather than internal.
Yeah, and it also means that as a huge colony, they can take care of themselves, they can, you know, control the environment, they create huge foraging tunnels from this mound and bring things back. Mm-hmm. And so it's really quite an advanced society to look at.
And although there are very little central control.
Absolutely.
Everything is distributed. And there's also very few types of termites, right? There is the soldier and the builder and the queen, I guess.
Yeah,
and
exactly. And so there are only a few types. Those types are somewhat flexible. Like you can actually get one to behave like the other in just by creating the right circumstances.
Ah, okay.
The queen is there for reproduction. Yeah. You know, this is no real...
Do they have some kind of a drone too when they go up and create a new colony?
They have a complicated way because they don't necessarily always have one queen. They can actually have like pairs and more. And so it's a little bit more complicated than with bees. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, like, you know, if you imagine that you could create robots that could build, right? Mm-hmm. Then those robots could control their environment. And one of the things I thought is like, what if you could put robots somewhere and the first thing they would build for themselves is a solar recharging station?
Then they become independent.
Then they become independent, right? I mean, they could control the environment. Maybe they can control the wind. I mean, they can certainly do things for us, mm-hmm. but you create robots that walk into an environment and if they can't climb it, they can create a staircase or a ramp to get over it. Mm-hmm. I think that could make even just our notion of a single robot more powerful. Mm-hmm. Even if we're not thinking about robots building architecture, it just makes a robot, you know, the next evolved state of robots, the robot that is an engineer and an architect.
Robotics 2.0.
Yeah. You know, the robot that is the engineer and the architect of its own environment. Mm-hmm. So I think it's exciting to think about these things, and it's exciting to try and take the first steps of just creating something that has that look and that feel like, you know, so the Termes project, we're really trying to move in that direction, create robots that carry things, build out of those things, and then climb over the very things they build.
Yeah, to build further.
Right. And that the building rules have to be like the termites.
Yeah.
No central control, no central point where every termite knows what every other termite is doing. All of the robots act somewhat independently. And just by changing the environment, they can influence other people's things. So if I built all the walls, you might start building the roof mm-hmm. because you see that all the walls are built and therefore you build the roof.
Without somebody actually telling you.
You're in charge of the roof.
Yeah.
Right. And it turned out that the person who was going to build the walls never showed up and there you are waiting to build the roof and you never get done.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you're getting these singularities and that's not good.
Yeah. And I think that kind of fault tolerance, if you have a more flexible system that's decentralized, I think that's one of the advantages of decentralized systems mm-hmm. is that they tend to have a certain level of robustness mm-hmm. and fault tolerance because a priori there isn't this fully, specified set of tasks. Instead, there is this sense that you are always adapting to the situation. You're adapting to your neighbors. Mm-hmm. You're adapting to the environment. You're adapting to faults. But the point is you're adapting and you may not care whose fault it was that a wall appeared in the wrong place. You now know that you have to remove it.
Yeah.
You don't care why it occurred.
This is also why central control usually doesn't work in the long run when we've seen it happen in the human society, because you have to be distributed to be redundant and to be fault tolerant. If you had an error in the central, suddenly everybody's doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
But if these smaller robots, if one of them do the wrong thing, it's going to be inconsequential because he's such a small part of the whole.
Yeah. And I think this is also something else that we have that we can learn from self-reconfigurable and modular robots is that, you know, how do we make the trade-off between centralized and decentralized? Like if you look at an organization, we all understand that if you took the person at top and you made them responsible for every decision, that before I sit down in a chair, I have to consult with the most superior of superiors, that the system would come to a grinding halt. So we actually rely very heavily on the fact that no one human has a brain 20 times, 30 times, 100 times larger than anyone else.
Yeah.
So you have limited bandwidth. Mm-hmm. It's true for robots as well. Every robot has a limited amount that it can handle. So there's always an advantage to taking an agent, even if they're humans. It's an advantage to have a team of humans. It's an advantage to have a big organization. Mm-hmm. For me, it's an advantage for me to have a whole group of people working on this project.
Because they can do much more than what you can do alone.
Exactly. And I depend on them being decentralized.
Yeah, you've got to trust the person in the room to do the right thing.
Right. Because if they all talk to me, we'd move at a snail's pace. Mm-hmm. So we rely on, every day we rely on decentralization, and I think we need to learn a little better how to use it. And modular robotics forces you to use it. I think it's actually fun.
There's simply no way of doing it.
Yeah, so you build a robot, or you build these termites building, or you build a snake robot, and you have to think, like, how does this work when each piece has to make the decisions about its motors and the other one has to make decisions about its motors, and how do they communicate?
But very local communication and very implicit communication.
Yeah, and I think it's a good practice for us to learn more about how good decentralized systems work. You know, and why they work, I think.
Yeah, because we do know.
We do know that they work, but I think you ask somebody.
They're building mounts, they're
absolutely
living happy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so we know we have a goal to strive for. That is, should be doable.
That's right. And I think we have a lot to learn there, because when you ask somebody, okay, you have 15 people, you know, they need to search the building. How are you going to do it? Yeah, they'll say, well, I put one in charge, and they'll tell everybody else what to do. But in reality, if you did that, it actually turns out to be a terrible idea. Yeah, you know, so
much less efficient.
And so when you ask people how to solve the problem, we often pick the centralized solution first, just because we feel more comfortable. So
it's also maybe to a certain degree that the hardware we have off the shelf is more orientated towards that approach.
That's true.
When we're trying to put a CPU in each custom built termite, we need special silicon, because we have very special demands, low power and size and weight
stuff.
There simply is no such component, and then you're forced to do it the other way, because the hardware isn't there.
I think compared to that, in computer networks, we've gone much further. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody expects that it's possible to make the one iPod that everybody uses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just take it for a fact. Well, I can't control the buying behavior of these millions of people who will buy a new gadget every 2 years. And that's just reality. I have this huge decentralized system. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, it has to work entirely based on the actions that people take, not on my own actions. No. I can set up infrastructure, but I can't force people.
No.
To
you have to, you as well as them, have to respond to the collective's behavior.
Exactly.
Like we talked about the swarm of birds before.
Exactly.
When we're talking about swarm robotics, I know you're also working on the Killabots project. And I also interviewed Michael Rubenstein. I hope we can talk a bit about the Killabots project.
Yeah, so Mike has really made this a reality. It's really exciting. I think from the very beginning, many of us have done lots of simulations, and we've always dreamed about having the ant colony, the thousands of robots. And Mike came in and he said, you know, the reason why we don't have thousands of robots is we don't think from the start that we want to build thousands of robots. If we thought from the start, then we would think also not just about the algorithmic issues, but the hardware issues. How do you design something that can exist in thousands? You know, if you have 1,000 of something in your lab, how are you going to maintain it? You know, how are you going to go around, you know,
turn them on and off, and
looking at their batteries, taking their batteries out, putting them in. And what are they going to cost? You know, who's going to be able to afford 1,000 of something when that one thing is, you know, $1,000 itself?
Yeah. And it's not so much fun if you actually afforded them. And then you can, okay, we got to distribute version 2 now.
Right,
so
right.
Throw those away
and
start again.
I actually think that he came upon a great idea that we should actually do over and over again, even though I want everybody to use the Killabots and they're the greatest thing ever. But which is that if we believe in collective behavior, we start from thinking that we want a huge collective and then work backwards. So the Killabot robots are really these really cute robots. They implement almost all of the swarm behavior things that you would want. Mm-hmm. So I think when we made them because we wanted 1,000 things. And now when I look at it, I really feel like the right market is for all of us to be able to use this kind of resource. Mm-hmm. So it implements, it can move on its own. You can control it just the way you would control any other robot. It can talk to its neighbors within a certain distance. Mm-hmm. And then you can make it behave like an ant colony, or make it behave like cells and form a shape of your choice, and maybe look at self-healing behavior or self-repairing behavior.
And you can do this in a reasonably practical manner.
That's
right.
It's a practical and economical manner. So they're the size of a I told somebody there's the size of a watch battery. And then they expected something half the size, because I realized that watches now have smaller batteries.
Yes. So they're size
they're like
of
a quarter. They're basically the size of a quarter, which
I'm
luckily is not changing
some,
size.
Some images up so people can see
them.
Yeah,
great. And you know, any smooth surface like a whiteboard or something, you know, that you purchase from Staples. You can put down and they run on them. They use vibration motors, which are themselves really fun, fun thing to play with, but it makes them very cheap. And so the idea was that these robots that implement most of the swarm behaviors that you would care about, or most of the swarm primitives that you would care about, like locomotion and communication, and maybe sensing external gradients like light, that all of that is, you know, in $14 of parts and maybe $6 of assembly. And so for $20-$25, you basically have a robot. And that robot can be controlled collectively. You don't have to turn on switches. You charge them all together. And so now the real question, I think, is one of creativity. Like, what will we do with these swarms?
What kinds of algorithms
make sense? Like, people talk about predator-prey. Like, how well do we understand predator-prey interactions? You could program, you know, 20 of the robots to be predators and the other ones to be prey, and then we could start implementing the things that the dolphins do with the fish schools. Do we really understand how they behave? Because it's one thing to say you have a hypothesis of the behavior. It's a different thing to actually be able to show that we can... We understand it like an engineer understands it, that we understand how to use it.
We can reproduce it, then we can show that if I do this change, it doesn't work anymore.
That's right. So, like, what would be a strategy for the fish to foil the predators?
Yeah.
That might be a very interesting question that we could now tackle by playing with these behaviors in physical systems where bumping into things or moving against things or congestion and traffic will actually really exhibit themselves very deeply, whereas in simulation, sometimes those things get lost, those physical interactions. Mm-hmm. So now with these physical robots, I think there's just a huge number of people come by, and every time they see them, they have something else. They say, we could do this and we could do that. And I love it because I do think collective behavior is something that many of us are interested in. We see collective intelligence throughout around us.
Yeah.
And it's
the predator
just
prey thing is just huge. Because there is also many systems. I mean, if you see, there is the predator-predator-prey where you have, for instance, the cheetah, they can hunt, but they can't defend their prey against their kill against the lion.
That's right.
So you have all these, you can study these things.
These societies. And somebody came and they wanted to study epidemic models.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, that's really interesting. Of course, you could think of, you know, you start with some robots that represent the epidemic, and as they move through the structure, they are infecting other ones through the communication structure, and then those ones are moving. And how quickly will the epidemic spread? What happens if you introduce, you know, the neutralizing agents into it?
Say that 10% of the community is vaccinated, or
20%. Exactly. And now we can play with physical models that incorporate not just information, but also motion. And I think that can lead to interesting things. You know, we do these in simulation, and I think that already does increase our understanding. But I think doing
said,
the physical.
We said that before. Doing it practically makes it so much more concrete. We're a physical human. We're a physical entity. We're human beings. Huh?
One of the things that Mike and I are specifically interested in is collective behavior that adapts to the size of the swarm. So let's say that you wanted to... termites do this. So they build a house, but the size of the house actually is related to the colony size. So as the colony gets bigger, they... somehow, without breaking the house down, they increase the size of the house. And bees will do this. And we also do a lot of tasks like that, where if there's more people, we just slightly adapt the strategy to work for more or less. We're not so fixated on there exactly 5 or exactly 10 people. So we've looked at programs where you have the system self-assemble a shape like a starfish. And then if we cut off the arm of the starfish, like take away all of the robots in the arm, we want the system to be able to reorganize to create a smaller starfish. And then if you add some back in, then they should figure out how to absorb them to make a larger starfish shape. And so you could do something really complicated, but still be able to adjust as the size of the group changes between really big numbers.
Yeah, that's interesting. And then, you can make the algorithm proportional. That's really
or maybe
cool.
You disperse them all and they come back and still form the same shape. And that's something that actually happens a lot in developmental biology. Cells are capable of doing all this kind of regeneration. And we want to know, could we understand regeneration well enough to create arbitrary structures that behave like these biological organisms, have automatically that notion of regeneration and self-repair? So that's something that we're interested in, but I imagine many groups are interested in many different kinds of aspects.
Yeah, and so this is also interesting because as I see it, this is one of the first instances where we see modular robotics and swarm robotics actually becoming a tool, not for roboticists, but for other people. I mean, if you're a biologist or, as you say, a medical professional, you want to study these things.
Yeah.
They could also be run to run simulations. We have this situation. Here's the data for the situation we know as of today. Let's run a simulation and we can do this on these physical robots.
That's right. And the physicists are also very interested in it. So we've talked a lot with people who study ant biology and physicists as well. And I think we have just have a lot to learn from each other. You know, in the case where we have termite-like robots that are climbing and building things, you know, one of the questions is, could we adapt some of the rules that termites build? So termites react to how wet a situation is, and they react to how dry things are. Mm-hmm. They react to how many neighbors they have. They react to pheromones that they leave. Yeah. And the belief is that by controlling your reaction strength, you actually can produce different kinds of mound structures. So different species are believed to have different predilections towards certain things, so that in the same environment, they build very different mound structures. And you can actually recognize one species from another just by looking at their mounds.
Yeah.
What if we could do that with the termite robots? Could they have these sort of behaviors that are only modulated?
In soft ground, they'd make a larger base.
Yeah, or they make it, you know, their structure changes. If it's really wet, then the walls start to get really thick. Or if it's really, it's not wet enough, then you start leaving lots of holes and windows in your structure. Mm-hmm. That would be really fun to try and take those ideas. And even for the biologists, it's very exciting because for them, it's a different way of looking at those rules. That yes, there's a real meaning to these adaptive rules that we can show works in a situation outside of the one that's been evolved, where it's a little hard to pull out the pieces and say, okay, does this fundamental piece mean anything versus this fundamental piece?
Yeah, now we can analyze that.
We can analyze that, use it, maybe even find a potential use for it. Same with the kilobots, I think. You know, there's a chance to take things like the physics of rods and shapes and triangles that move with random motion and actually spontaneously self-assemble. Mm-hmm. Like, I think one of the things I would like to do is have the kilobots follow the rules that are used by water molecules and self-assemble different snowflakes.
Yeah.
And, you know, the snowflakes...
That'd be different every time.
And the snowflakes have, although they're different every time, there's a relationship between the temperature in which they form and the kind of snowflakes that are formed. So we could shine the table with a light that sort of represented the temperature and you let them modulate between their desire to stick with their neighbors and their desire to not do it, you know, desire to just float away towards more light, and see if we could just recreate the biology, I mean, the nature, the physics of
and
snowflake formation.
Yeah,
and understand
then we understand that more.
Yeah. And I think there's just a huge amount that we can understand just by these physical objects replicating the behavior that we want. I think it's very quick to point out holes in your understanding when they're physical objects moving around.
Yeah, yeah. We talked about this is the third time we mentioned it, I think. And I think that this is really great because with the advent of commercially or practically available, or I guess the kilobot's going to be open source.
Yes,
even. So if you want to do your own, just go check the web page. I'm naturally going to link to it, and you'll have all the information you need there. What do you think is the what if you would like to throw out a challenge there and something you think that I know it's a cool idea, I haven't had time to look into it right now. Is it maybe we're talking about swarm robotics and the TERMS project is also non-self reconfiguring, they're not stick together. Is there something around that you think is interesting, or what would you challenge the community to address as the next issue?
Yeah, I guess I threw out the challenge of the camping trip already. So I think that is a challenge. I don't really know what's a good way to think about it. Mm-hmm. But one of the ones that, you know, I think they're very practical challenges with the TERMS projects. Like, could we actually build levees, for example?
Yeah,
robots
yeah.
with sandbags build levees autonomously.
Yeah.
So rescue structures.
Because that's also dangerous environments.
It's dangerous. It would be very practical. And it would show that we could move in real open environments. I think that would be a huge challenge to take these ideas that are still in the lab and just say, okay, we're going to customize them for a particular application. But that application comes with so much uncertainty of its own. Mm-hmm. And see if we can make robots construct you know, in your backyard, you know, construct a little levee around whatever it is, the pool that you set up that's full of water, and do something where they're moving around objects that are heavy and manipulating. But the other more scientific one that I would think of is, I've spent some time now talking to people who study army ants and study the weaver ants. And these are amazing. You know, the weaver ants in particular will climb on top of each other and then hang down as chains and form these long links. Mm-hmm. And with those links, they can actually take leaves and fold the leaves together. So they make their houses out of leaves. Mm-hmm. But the way they do is they make a chain with their bodies across the leaf. And then they basically run against each other to make this chain shorter and shorter.
Ah, that's beautiful.
You know,
huh? And that's kind of like they're creating an actuator with their own bodies.
With their own bodies.
It's a custom actuator every time.
Exactly. It's a custom actuator. If you need more of them, they'll make more chains in parallel. Mm-hmm. That kind of cooperative behavior, like how would we... I think that as we learn more about materials and novel actuators, we're actually at the point where we could start thinking about, like, how would you build that ant? The ant that climbs on top of each other or that hangs off of each other, mm-hmm. that can build these massive actuators and act together. Mm-hmm. And I think it would just be really exciting.
So I could have my own lazy boy made of ants. And it would
That's
suit
right.
me just as good it would suit you.
Yeah,
I mean,
be more tense
size.
Or, you know, don't be less tense or,
yeah.
you know, and it would just
Some
sort of change.
That would be nice.
You know, I think...
Or
I
just
think
the fact
you...
that it usually becomes sweaty in the end. You could have it so that it supports your body at different places.
I love modular. Modular furniture is the best thing ever if we could ever figure out how to do it. That's a great challenge. That's your challenge. You should set that one out, which is create the lazy boy that is completely, you know... reconfigurable in a way, right?
Yeah.
That would be really terrific. I think I was thinking more like, could we even just replicate what these ants can do? You know, build these chains that can get longer and longer and increase at their base and don't rip apart, you know, somehow.
I
think there's just a lot we could learn just from staring at nature and figuring out why and how it evolves. Because we already know it works and there must be tricks that make it work. Mm-hmm. I think that would move us really closer to that idea of something that's self-reconfiguring and reconfigures to fit the environment and take full advantage of the environment. So that's my current one, and I don't know when I'll get to it. But if somebody else gets first, that's great.
Yeah, perfect. So thank you very much for being part of the podcast. It's lovely to have you here, and I'm hoping and I know that we're going to hear from you again. So thank you for being part of it.
All right. Thank you very much.
And that's it for today. Check out our website for further details and links to all the exciting projects discussed today. As always, we welcome your comments and feedback, which you can submit via the website or send to info@robotspodcast.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Goodbye. Organize with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.